How can journalism make people care and bring about solutions? What role does storytelling play in shining a light on injustice and crises and creating a catalyst for change?
Nicholas Kristof is a two-time Pulitzer-winning journalist and political commentator. He has covered, among many other events and crises, the Tiananmen Square protests, the Darfur genocide, the Yemeni civil war, and the U.S. opioid crisis. Kristof is a regular CNN contributor and an op-ed columnist for the New York Times. His memoir, Chasing Hope, A Reporter's Life, was published in May 2024.
Nicholas Kristof, welcome to the Creative Process and One Planet podcast.
Delighted to be with you.
Nick, you've been to 170 countries, and in your book, Chasing Hope, you've written on the value of witnessing the world's atrocities, neglected conflicts, human rights abuses, and how you then turn these into stories that will call on people to act. But first, you know, how do you find your way into a story to find that personal detail that makes us all care, and not just see the immensity, but care about these individual lives so that we feel that there's a possibility that we can create better futures?
So the backdrop of that came when I was trying to cover the Darfur genocide in the early 2000s. And I was making these trips and reporting on the, you know, horrific massacres. And it just felt as if these columns were just disappearing without a ripple. And meanwhile, at the same time in New York City, all of Manhattan was up in arms about these two hawks that had been pushed out of an apartment building where they had a nest because the building didn't like their bird droppings. And I thought, you know, how is it that I can't generate the same outrage about hundreds of thousands of people being massacred as people, you know, feel for these two homeless hawks? What's wrong with my writing? Why can't I connect with people on these issues? And so that led me to the work of What Makes Us Care. And one of those lessons is that it's an emotional process. It's an emotional connection, not a rational one. And so you have to tell stories, and you have to tell stories about individuals. And so that is why when I'm covering these humanitarian issues or mass atrocities, I'm always going out and trying to find not just an individual story, but the most compelling story, you know, a child, somebody that people can relate to and, frankly, make readers spill their coffee.
Yes, indeed. I also wondered what role growing up in a small town in Oregon does when you get to know almost everyone in a town and you can see behind their stories in a way in all the sectors of that society that we might not get in big cities where we get this tunnel vision and we just stick with our groups.
So I think that growing up in a tiny town very much affected my journalism and how I see the world. But I think it was perhaps in the sense that it has always felt to me that Washington and the national media establishment, for that matter, kind of neglect small towns like mine and people like those around me and the issues that concern us. I mean, right now, one is addiction. We've got more than 100,000 people a year dying from overdoses, including many of my old friends. And I don't think that America has come to terms with that adequately. And so I think the same is true when we go to other countries, that when we in journalism try to cover what is happening in some other country, we go to the Capitol, we talk to officials, we typically talk to university-educated men who speak English over 50. And that's a pretty tiny slice. And so I think that has encouraged me to go leave the Capitol, talk to other people, try to engage and understand what is happening more broadly.
And you talked there about the personal stories, the emotional stories. And I just wonder, because you have to get close, you know, so how do you protect yourself emotionally and at the same time keep your empathy in check, skepticism, and all these things, your critical thinking or neutrality, and these emotionally charged situations when you might be meeting warlords or covering human trafficking and witnessing these terrors. Like you begin Chasing Hope in a very personal story, going down in a small plane in the heart of the Congo Civil War. So with so much going on around you, how do you remain clear-minded in those situations? And also journalistically, how do you develop that courage and that strength?
Well, I haven't really figured it out. In writing Chasing Hope, I kind of self-diagnosed myself with maybe a mild case of PTSD, which just shows how hard it is to manage these issues. I do think, and I'm not proud of it, that over the years and decades, I developed a certain emotional armor. And it's probably a little parallel to an emergency room physician who is surrounded by trauma victims, but You just have to create some distance from that pain just to get through the day. And I think I do have some of that armor, and I can sleep at night after seeing a massacre. But where my armor breaks down is in particular where children are involved, or where somebody that I am close to, maybe my interpreter or something like that, has been in jeopardy, or I fear that I put somebody at risk. And that haunts me. Every now and then, sort of unexpectedly, you'll interview somebody and, you know, I just find myself completely tearing up, and it has somehow penetrated my armor and it gets to you. And also, I spend a lot of my time terrified when I'm on these stories, and that builds up. Your gut clenches, and at some point it becomes a little harder to unclench.
Yeah, exactly. What happens when you come back from these heavily charged situations? You know, I don't know that process, but you describe it very well in your book. So perhaps now would be a good time to read a passage from Chasing Hope.
Yeah, and actually you alluded to my plane crash in the Congo, which is how I begin Chasing Hope. And I thought I would actually begin with that because it frames a little bit the journalism that I do and that I believe in, but also the risks that it brings. So this is the beginning of Chasing Hope. Journalism is an act of hope. What impels reporters forward is our faith that if we get the story and shine a light in the darkness, the public will respond and change will come. That's why reporters rush toward gunfire, talk their way into drug dens, scramble toward riots, and, in my case right now, take a small plane into the heart of the Congo Civil War. Our adventures are not always well executed, however, and at the moment I'm not brimming with hope. The plane is in trouble, and I'm petrified, thinking, so this is how I die. Not in old age, inconsolable grandchildren at my bedside on the family farm in Oregon, with the farm dogs giving up gopher hunting to come inside and muzzle their goodbyes. No, my end is looming far from family in a fiery plane crash in the vast Congo rainforest. I'm in a chartered plane with other journalists. Our small plane is sputtering, the pilot steadily losing control. It looks as if my ashes won't be scattered on the farm and on the Pacific Crest Trail, as I had hoped, but rather my remains will mingle with termite mounds in a jungle on the other side of the world. A baboon or okapi may notice, but no one else will. I guess I'm not giving anything away, but I actually do survive that plane crash.
Yes, you do, and I don't know how many other instances. And so you somehow kind of insulate yourself, but there's things that get through. And I'm just wondering about, of all the places that you've been and the things that you've seen, what gives you hope? But what are some of those things that you carry with you that might still haunt you?
June 4th, 1989, and Tiananmen Square in China is certainly high on that list. You know, maybe because it was the first thing like that I saw. I was the Beijing bureau chief of the New York Times and had covered the Tiananmen democracy movement. It had seemed so full of hope, and it seemed as if maybe democracy was going to come to China and greater freedom, and there was a leadership fight and unclear who was going to win. And that terrible night of June 3rd to 4th, 1989, I heard that the troops were busting through student lines and headed toward Tiananmen. I rode my bike out. I got to Tiananmen Square a little bit before the troops did, and then they arrived and opened fire on the crowd that I was in. And I was terrified, but to watch a modern army turn weapons of war on unarmed protesters, you don't forget that. That changes you. And I guess I also think of it in a larger context, and maybe especially as democracy has become an issue here in the U.S. in recent years. And frankly, I was a little bit disdainful, maybe, of some of the less educated protesters at Tiananmen, the peasants from the countryside, the workers. And I wrote periodically that, oh, they say they're for democracy, but they can't define the kind of democracy they're in favor of. They can't talk about the institutions they want, the guardrails. And that was all true. But that night, it was those uneducated workers and peasants who were driving their rickshaws out whenever there was a pause in the firing to pick up bodies of kids who'd been killed or injured, who blocked the troops. You know, one bus driver, salt-of-the-earth bus driver, he saw the convoy of troops coming in trucks, and he parked his bus across the road to keep the trucks away and turned off the engine. And then when the officer pointed his firearm at him and demanded he move the bus, this bus driver just hurled the keys into the grassy verge into the high grass. People like that might not have been able to define democracy, but they were willing to risk their lives for it. And I do think that they have an appreciation for the virtues of democracy that we in the U.S. sometimes don't. We take it for granted. And I think there's a lot we in this country can learn from the courage and commitment of people like that whom I witnessed in June 1989.
Yeah, it was so moving, that coverage. And those other books that you've written, you co-authored with your wife, Cheryl Boudin, of course, China Wakes and Half the Sky. And you not just discussed Tiananmen Square, but you, of course, jointly received the Pulitzer, which I think is the first time for a couple to jointly receive a Pulitzer. So this is a true companionship and a real creative journalistic collective. So what is that like to work with your wife, and how do you jointly tell a story?
It's funny because people always ask that question, and there's a little bit of a hint of, how do you guys write books together and stay married? And we also have three kids. And the truth is that if you can raise kids together and stay married, a book is a piece of cake. It really is. And, you know, you put a manuscript down at night, it stays down. A manuscript can't play you off each other. And at the end of the day, if you screw up on a manuscript, it's only a manuscript. It's not like screwing up on a kid. And I'd also say more seriously that it really helped to have Cheryl and me working on these things together. China, after Tiananmen, was a somewhat dispiriting time. We were tailed a lot. It really helped. We dealt with really tough ethical decisions, and it really helped to have somebody who was engaged in this business, who understood the risks. You know, we could talk through some of these questions about what our moral responsibilities were to our sources, to our readers. When we wrote Half the Sky about empowering women around the world, you know, if it had been just a woman writing that book, I think it would have been marginalized as just a woman's issue. And it would have been weird if it had been just a man writing it. But I think a man and a woman addressing gender inequity together underscored that this is a issue that affects all of us, whatever our sex, and that we all have to get to work to try to address it. So it's been a wonderful partnership.
I love that. And I'm wondering also, when you're going to these different countries, how are you, you know, getting into the mindset? You talked about the survival mode or developing your instincts and your situational awareness and intuitive intelligence and all these things. You know, what you've learned in one country, you could apply to another, but how do you then go about tuning into those different cultural signals, like in 170 countries?
I mean, that's really hard, and I don't always get it right. And I'm regularly bouncing into countries where I don't speak the local language, where I don't have a deep familiarity of the culture and the history. I mean, we lived in China, and yet we regularly got the things wrong. In the early 90s, there was a big family planning crackdown, but it was basically in rural areas. It was, you know, homes being knocked down if you had an extra child, and livestock and furniture taken, this kind of thing. I was doing a fair amount of reporting in rural areas and asking people what was going on. But still, it took me basically 2 years to put this together. And here was one of the biggest crackdowns affecting more people in a more intimate way than almost anything else anywhere on the planet. And it took me 2 years to notice. And I was one of the first people to notice. You know, it's hard. And I remember in China once, there was a local news article and it reported an anecdote about somebody who'd gone through something, and it reported his name was Mo. And so I was ready to write this case that affected Mr. Mo. And then I realized at the last minute, fortunately, that that's like saying Jane Doe or something. It's not a real name. It's like a Jane Doe kind of a shortcut. And that would have been very embarrassing if I'd managed to say Jane Doe was caught up in this anecdote.
And I mean, it's so interesting because your book charts when you're first stationed in China and Hong Kong, and you had a, you know, plum position there as a foreign correspondent, and journalism has changed so much. You talk about there not being expense accounts and various things, but you had that time to explore, that time to notice. Whereas now with the attention economy, it's like clickbait, and you can tell me firsthand.
You know, what are your reflections on the future of journalism?
There are all kinds of changes. And part of it is that the business model for journalism is kind of collapsing. And traditionally, newspapers were often monopolies or oligopolies. And so they were making money. And so they were perfectly fine being committed to covering important things that readers weren't terribly interested in. And that business model has already collapsed for local journalism around the country. We're losing an average of 2.5 newspapers each week around the country, We've lost more newspaper journalists than we have coal miners over the last decade. And in terms of national, international coverage, then look, the New York Times still has a good business model. The Washington Post has a business model in the sense of Jeff Bezos has a large checkbook. The Wall Street Journal is doing okay, but the news weeklies are collapsing. The television is struggling. So if you think about the world right now, there are still reporters covering the war in Ukraine. There are still folks covering the war in Gaza. But you don't have reporters covering what's probably the world's biggest humanitarian crisis right now, the famine in Sudan, you know, with some exceptions, of course. But it isn't getting much coverage. Yemen wasn't getting much coverage when it was the biggest crisis. And I think that's fundamentally because it's expensive and dangerous to cover those kinds of international stories. And there's not much of an audience for it. Once I did back-to-back columns about the Yemen humanitarian crisis and Brett Kavanaugh when he was nominated for the Supreme Court. And the Kavanaugh piece I could whip off in a few hours. The Yemen piece resulted from an expensive, somewhat dangerous trip to Yemen. And it wasn't just that the Kavanaugh piece got 50% more page views or double the number. It got seven times as many page views. And so you can understand why an executive producer doesn't want to send a camera crew to Yemen when they can put a Democrat and a Republican in a studio together and have them yell at each other.
Yes, it's that entertainment and journalism. But, you know, you've actually been a light for journalists and really inspiring in terms of what can we do to deal with situations in our own country, but what can we do for those around the world? Your writing has inspired notably Bill and Melinda Gates to focus their philanthropy on global health. And the former head of the International Rescue Committee said your coverage of the genocide in Darfur saved hundreds of thousands of lives. So considering the changing face of journalism, how can we continue to be catalysts for positive change, considering all these issues that you have mentioned?
Well, boy, I hope that we come up with a solid business model for journalism. And one may emerge. The New York Times really has managed to put one together. And that's why it's covering these things. I'm actually planning a trip to Sudan right now, and it will probably lose money for the Times, but the Times is willing to send me to cover pieces that maybe only my mother and wife will read. But we need a better business model for journalism as a whole. I think that there may be ways for journalists to partner with aid groups around the world to help cover crises. And it may be that think tanks also, who already do some reporting on these kinds of issues, that think tanks will also manage to cover some of these issues.
Indeed. And you talk about drawing that line because you have to draw that line without being sponsored. So how would you manage that?
I don't know. We're going to have to figure this out. But I think of aid groups that are in Yemen, that are in Sudan, and they obviously have to worry about, you know, if they help with reporting, then maybe they'll be kicked out. They may have their own interests that news organizations will have to be very wary of. But like the Boston Globe used to have foreign correspondents. Now it doesn't have any. And so there may be some Boston folks who are in Sudan or Syria with an aid group and might be able to contribute in ways that the aid group approves of, to get more attention to these issues, and it also will help readers of the Boston Globe. But I'm kind of making that up as I go along. And I also think that, frankly, it's not just half a world away. I mean, I don't think we in the media do an adequate job covering poverty at home, covering addiction at home, people left behind. So I think there the problem isn't so much cost. It's just that they're perceived as not ones that will have a built-in audience.
Indeed. It makes me think about you were going to run for governor in Oregon, maybe thinking about how you could apply these skills and make those changes. I think you would have been a great candidate.
Thank you. Yeah, I was tossed off the ballot by the Secretary of State. And so my wife says that this side of Kim Jong-un in North Korea, I'm the only person to have had an entire political career and never had a single person cast a ballot against him, which is a nice way of phrasing it. But, you know, that arose from seeing a lot of pain that has been unaddressed. And it's kind of rooted in my own community, that in this farming community here, about a third of the kids on my old school bus are now dead from drugs, alcohol, and suicide. And it's just been heartbreaking to watch. And in many cases, they suffered greatly, but they also inflicted great suffering on others. You know, hurt people hurt others. and when it's a low education area, when people lost jobs in the sawmill or in the factory, then they weren't prepared for a 21st century economy. And then they self-medicated with meth. The family structure collapsed. And it's been really painful to watch. I don't think the political system has adequately addressed these issues. And the urban-rural divide is enormous in Oregon as well as all around the country. So that was what impelled me to make that leap. But it was not to be. So now I, you know, chase windmills using my journalistic tools, not political ones.
Yes. And it was just a question of that you weren't resident in the state all the time. So we should put that detail out there.
It wasn't for my criminal record. Our view was that the Secretary of State pushed me out because I was leading in the polls and leading in fundraising. Now, she would have a different view, but she pushed me out based on an argument about residency.
Yes, you can be punished for your goodness. And I can see how you would really rally people behind you because you care. And that's not a flaw at all. You talked about low educational levels in your community. Of course, your parents were educators. And I know that you've also done mentorship programs where you've brought some young journalists to be foreign correspondents with you, taking them on the road to try to bring them along that pathway towards journalism. And I just wonder what your reflections are broadly about education, because you've been an outspoken advocate for education reform and how we can improve our education models to do exactly that, prepare people for not just the jobs of the 21st century, but to just be more engaged global citizens.
If you look over the last 500 years or so, the best metric to predict where a society will be in 30 or 50 years, the best metric is simply education today. And the one reason I think the U.S. is the world's largest and most successful economy today is because beginning in the 19th century and through about 1970, the U.S. led the world in mass education. And what matters is not so much elite education. Britain had Eton, it had Oxford and Cambridge, it had better elite education, but it wasn't great at mass education. And the U.S. really was. We were the first country to have almost universal literacy, male and female. We were the first country to have widespread high school attendance, then the first country to have significant college attendance. And then beginning in about the 1970s, we lost that lead. And now there are many countries that are way ahead of us. And I think back to my old classmates who are now dead. And I think, what were adults thinking in the 1970s that they let them drop out? And yet I think today, what are adults thinking in 2024 when they let 1 in 7 American kids today drop out of high school and let so many emerge from the school system not literate, not numerate, completely unprepared for the 21st century? And this is one of those issues that isn't particularly partisan. Probably the best states in the country in terms of K-12 education are Democratic ones with strong teacher unions, Massachusetts and New Jersey. But the state that has probably had the biggest gains in K-12 education over the last 15 years is Mississippi, a red state with weak teacher unions. And there are lessons to be learned across the board. But in America, we're very good at investing in the human capital of our own children and very poor at investing in the human capital of children as a whole.
Yeah. And so that leads me to ask, what are your reflections on capitalism generally today? Because we now, of course, monetize everything and everything has become a marketplace, including education.
Living in China and to some extent reporting in East Asia made me, I think, more sympathetic to capitalism than a lot of my fellow liberals, simply because I saw many of the problems of the planned economy and also just how good capitalism was at generating economic growth, and that if the pie can be divided more equally, then boy, a rapidly growing pie is a good thing. And capitalism in the U.S. worked incredibly well between about 1945 and 1975. And since then, it's worked much less well. And the pie has gotten bigger, but it's been divided less equitably. And I think that one of the lessons is the need to make sure that we are in charge. And we, meaning society as a whole and the public good, and that's going to mean some regulation, but not enough to stifle economic growth. And that's a fine balance that I'm not sure we get right. I'm not sure Europeans get right. And I think it's going to be even more important with AI and the AI revolution. which certainly risks vast numbers of jobs and will just change economy and society in many, many ways.
Yes, it's shaking up everything. It's going to change, I think, everyone's jobs, except perhaps those who are designing AI. And even them, they don't know. I've spoken to these designers. They don't know how it works. When you hear that, it's cause for concern.
Yeah. No, I think that actually coders who are designing AI, I think that their own jobs are at risk, because at some point AI will get better at coding itself than human coders are. And so there'll still be have to be managers overseeing the process. But I think the coding profession is at some risk as well.
Well, I guess that's some consolation. But for somebody who's always gone out into the world, someone who derived their knowledge from that one-on-one understanding what it is in the world, and AI doesn't do that, what are your reflections on how it's changing the way we communicate with ourselves and our imagination, your own profession, journalism, and how can we prepare young people and just everyone for these uncertain futures?
There have been some alarming experiments that show that AI arguments are better at persuading people than humans are at persuading people. And I think that's partly because we humans tend to make to others the arguments that we ourselves find most persuasive. And so a liberal will make the arguments that will appeal to liberals, but the person you're probably trying to persuade is somebody at the center. And I think we're not good at putting ourselves in other people's shoes. That's something I try very hard to do in the column, but I often fall short. I think that people are going to become more vulnerable to this, to being manipulated. I think we're also at risk of being manipulated by our own cognitive biases and the tendency to reach out for information sources that will confirm our prejudices. Years ago, the theorist Nicholas Negroponte wrote that the internet was going to bring a product that he called the Daily Me, which was going to be basically information that was, you know, perfectly targeted to our own brains. And that's kind of what we've gotten now. And a conservative will get conservative sources that show how awful Democrats are and will have information that buttresses that point of view. And liberals will get the liberal version of that. And I think we have to, all of us, try to understand those cognitive biases, understand the degree to which we are all vulnerable to being fooled by our brains, by selection bias. And I'd like to see high schools in particular have more information training and media literacy programs so that they learn that there are some news sources that are a little better than others. And just because you see something on Facebook doesn't make it true, but that there are some sources like the New York Times or Wall Street Journal or Washington Post that get things wrong, but that are somewhat more reliable than others and that in general try to get things right.
Exactly. There's checks and balances. And I guess with AI, it is important to understand fake news and misinformation, disinformation. Of course, it has direct bearing on our elections as well. You said your experience in China helped you have a certain respect for the mechanisms of capitalism, even though it doesn't work perfectly. And it hasn't worked perfectly in terms of how we are stewards of the planet. This you've seen from your travels around the world, because we're looking at the bottom line, and often it makes us make these decisions that causes ecological degradation because we're not seeing further down the line in the future. So what in your view is holding us back from moving forward on that?
So I think that the problem is kind of classic economic problems of the tragedy of the commons and the fact that any one country is going to benefit if other countries reduce carbon emissions, but is going to suffer when it itself does. And so there's always a tendency to want other countries to lead the way. And there are also legitimate arguments about whether what matters is how much each country is putting out today in terms of carbon and how much it has since the Industrial Revolution began. And the U.S. point of view is that, look, we can't get anywhere unless India and China reduce carbon emissions. And India and China say, well, if you look over the last 100 years, then you're the ones who put out all the carbon. And we're just finally getting a little bit richer and you want to cut us off at the knees. And there are arguments to be made on both sides. But I think that is the fundamental impediment. I've got to say that 10 years ago, it just seemed really hard to see how we were going to get out of climate change and disastrous consequences. Right now, if you squint a little bit, you can maybe see a path through this period where we do manage to reduce carbon emissions enough to figure out how to navigate our way to a future in which things work and we pay a price, but one that is manageable. And that is partly because green energy is becoming much cheaper, because batteries are becoming so much better. I mean, a revolution in battery technology. And there are also other possibilities further afield, like energy generated by waves or fusion nuclear power, removing carbon from the air, direct air capture. You know, we're not sure that these will work, but they may. And they would really be revolutionary. If we could get direct air capture of carbon and then sequester that, if we could do that at an economical rate, boy, that would make a real difference. It's just not sure that we're going to get there.
Yes. Well, with renewable energy, I mean, within this decade, we've made so much progress. And, you know, China, where you were based for so many years, becoming the first electro state. So I am chasing that hope, too, that we seize the day on this.
Yeah, absolutely. China is an interesting example of a country that has made remarkable progress on electrification and on battery technology. And it is still pushing out a ton of carbon, but it has done this for practical reasons, that it understands that those are key technologies for the future. Whoever figures out how to get electric vehicles done right, who figures out how to get battery technology right, the world is going to benefit from their progress in battery technology, for example, just as the world has benefited by having solar panels made in China go up all over the world.
And you'd mentioned India, and I just thought it was so interesting. You've presented a nuanced view that I hadn't heard about from many people. You've argued that we have this kind of negative view of sweatshops, but that while exploitative, they can be a necessary step in a country's economic development. And that countries that have embraced this historically, say Korea or Taiwan, have now fared better. It's not necessarily a black and white situation. It may be a step on the road to development for a country.
Yeah, you're going to get me in trouble on college campuses, Mia. But it's true. And I think that, in fact, we tend to understate the problem of sweatshops, because it's not only that workers are not paid very much, but it's also that they often, depending on the economic sector, they often pollute local waterways, for example, and cause other problems. At the end of the day, the one thing in a very poor country, even worse than being exploited in a sweatshop, is to have no job at all, or to work on a farm in a rice paddy, earning no money, having no future. And we have seen, in Asia in particular, that sweatshops were a path to raise living standards. And I remember in Indonesia talking to a mom with her young son who were scavengers in a garbage dump, which is one of the worst jobs one can have. And I asked her what she hoped for her young son. And her dream for him was that he would grow up and work in a sweatshop. And that stuck with me. And it's very easy for Americans to denounce sweatshops, and their rationales are pretty good. I mean, they're real problems, and some of those can be corrected, like fire exits being blocked. That should not be tolerated. Sexual harassment of workers is likewise a problem. But you just demand that, you know, Nike pay more to workers, then the upshot is that the companies are not going to source production in the poorest countries. They're going to go to somewhat richer countries. They're going to go to Malaysia rather than Madagascar or Ethiopia. And indeed, already the really poorest countries, they haven't been able to participate in that manufacturing boom, because a company could only do that profitably if it paid so little that people would jump on them as exploiters. And so this hasn't managed to help the poorest countries and the poorest people in the world.
Indeed, it can be a pathway. That was enlightening, and I hope you don't get into trouble. But we can't expect that exporting our version of democracy or industrialization, you know, that's another modern slavery, if we just impose. There's so many vivid, fascinating stories. I don't know how you cope with it mentally, emotionally. When you mentioned Indonesia, I recall that passage in your book, and you see a group of men on motorcycles driving, you know, there's a head on a spike they're carrying around. I mean, I just don't know how you steel yourself for that. And how do you pick these moments out of all these stories that you've experienced? There was like a volume two in this, definitely.
I mean, that was terrifying. I will never forget that afternoon. And it wasn't just that there was this mob running around beheading people and dragging their naked, headless bodies behind them on the roads. It was that they were going after what they called were sorcerers. And I was a little bit afraid that they might mistake me for a sorcerer. And I remember thinking, boy, I hope if I'm killed, I hope that my head doesn't end up on a pike and I'm not dragged behind motorcycles with my naked headless body, that there are some ways that are better to die. And just thinking, this is crazy that I'm thinking, boy, I hope I'm just shot. That was a really terrifying afternoon. And then I remember I bought food for this gang of young men who I was interviewing about this, because I thought that maybe if they're well fed, they're going to be less likely to mistake me for a sorcerer. And then left. And a few hours later, I was showering in the Surabaya Hilton and feeling safe and calling Cheryl and developing my film of this horrific episode. And you feel you've escaped, you feel safe, but that memory and that fear, that doesn't go away so quickly.
Hello, my name is Henny Jong, a student at the University of Chicago studying English and creative writing, and I'm delighted to be collaborating on this episode. Hearing others, including Nick, including my parents and peers, speak about China's rapid development is always so interesting because it reaffirms for me a kind of alarming thickness or doubleness of my life in China that I've become increasingly aware of. For context, I live in Shanghai, and I have for most of my life. It's a place I'd always thought I liked to call home for as long as humanly possible. Now, a few years ago, I read a book on Shanghai's history written by an American journalist. And to be clear, I'm not implying anything about Nick's own work by saying this. It was a good book. Save for that one part where it claimed that Shanghai, with its lightstick postcard skyline, was a poster of a city more than it was a real city. At the time, I was annoyed. You mean to say that 26 million people and I didn't have a real relationship with the city? That we didn't live real lives within it? Well, I did, and I loved it. But years later, amidst the ongoing economic slump that heavily impacted my family, it became impossible to ignore the fact that my love for Shanghai had only been possible because I hadn't had to sustain it. Around me and in the lives of my peers, I witnessed only the city's rise and was shielded by my family from the risks. But those are the obvious conclusions. What torments me are the conclusion's corollaries. Was my affection for Shanghai less real because it was comfortable? Is it more real when it becomes more difficult? Does going abroad and returning to the city a little more an outsider now make it all clearer to me what's a poster and what's a city? And Nick's work also makes me think, how does media rearrange so-called lived reality or fail to do so? The cultural theorist Susan Sontag famously wrote in On Photography that repeated exposures to photographs and news reports of suffering will blunt their individual impact. The reality of war is dulled in repetition. It numbs its viewers. Years later, in Regarding the Pain of Others, Sontag revises that view. To speak of reality as diluted by media representations, she writes, is to, quote, universalize the viewing habits of a small educated population living in the rich part of the world where news has been converted to entertainment. There are hundreds of millions of television watchers who are far from inured to what they see on television. They do not have the luxury of patronizing reality, unquote. In Chasing Hope, Nick recounts watching photojournalists rush towards instead of away from gunfire. He himself risked his life to shine a light on war and genocide. In a war zone, he is a civilian, yet also not. But maybe this isn't so far from the rest of us. With the genocide in Gaza, wars in Ukraine, Syria, Sudan, DR Congo, and all the acute and chronic crises too numerous to list, I wonder, does anyone have the luxury of patronizing reality? As if a certain kind of suffering or oppression can only happen elsewhere. Or as Martin Niemöller considers in his poem, First They Came, if you don't speak out for anyone, what will you do when there is no one left to speak for you? This isn't a rhetorical question. Any answer is necessarily heavy, long, and messy, and real. But it's something we have to keep returning to as we read and watch. And now, back to the interview.
Yeah, I just don't know how you steel yourself to understand that. And then when you have such a limited space, say in your article, you know, the days of long-form journalism, it's difficult. And we're so glad that Chasing Hope allows us to understand some of these backstories that make or don't make the cut when you're writing an article. So how do you narrow that down when there's so many fascinating details to explore? What would be the most poignant to bring across the essence of the story?
That's the perpetual challenge of storytelling. It's what Homer was wrestling with 2,800 years ago and what we wrestle with today. But I think that one of the lessons of storytelling is you pick the elements that will move a reader, that will lead them somewhere. In my case, I'm trying to get people to care about a crisis in ways that may reduce that crisis, that may bring solutions to it. And so I'm trying to pick the elements that are going to help make a solution, perhaps imperfectly. And I think that's also how I deal with the terror and the fear, that I do find a sense of purpose in what I do. And it's scary. It's incredibly heartbreaking to see some of the things and hear some of the stories. But at the end of the day, it feels like inconsistently, here and there, you can shine a light on problems. And by shining that light, you actually make a difference. And that is really heartening.
Yes, and you've shared incredibly nuanced stories with the world. Your enduring concern for the oppressed and overlooked is really inspiring. A remarkable example of what can be done when you take the time.
So as you think about the future and those teachers or mentors, collaborators that have been important to you, the importance of storytelling and the arts, what would you like young people to know, preserve, and remember?
So this is something that I talk about a little bit near the end of Chasing Hope, that when I was young, I think like a lot of young people today, I was focused on what might be called resume qualities. You know, I was proud to be the youngest foreign correspondent at the Times and the youngest national correspondent, winning a Pulitzer and this kind of thing. But over time, I think I came to see more importance and more reward in finding a purpose, in finding meaning, in paying it forward, in giving back, in the eulogy qualities, if you will, the kind of things people say in, when they remember you. And those aren't the resume qualities, but it's the importance of finding friends and emphasizing family and doing things that give you that sense of fulfillment and meaning that keep you going and that give you perspective in a crisis. And when we all suffer, whether it's health crises, health scares, other problems that kind of give you some cause larger than yourself to hold on to. I'm not sure I got it at the beginning of my career, and I think it's maybe hard for young people to always grasp, but that would be the advice that I would offer.
Well, thank you, Nicholas Kristof, for sharing your purpose and shining light on all these stories, your commitment to chasing hope, and dedicating yourself to the power of storytelling and bearing witness to help us understand that we can create a better tomorrow. We all live on one planet we call home. Thank you for adding your voice to One Planet Podcast and the creative process.
Thank you, Mia.
The Creative Process and One Planet Podcast are supported by the Jan Michalski Foundation. This interview was conducted by Mia Funk with the participation of collaborating universities and students. Associate interview producer on this episode were Katie Foster and Henny Zhang. Associate text editor on this episode was Nadia Lam. One Planet Podcast is produced by Mia Funk with additional production support by Sophie Garnier. The theme music was written and performed by Juan Sanchez. We hope you've enjoyed this program and listening to the highlights of this podcast. If you'd like to get involved in One Planet Podcast or learn more about environmental projects, click on the subscribe button. Thank you for listening.